is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here through the hour to help you by answering your questions about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you have a question for Zorba? Well, then this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Zorba, always some interesting topics and research to talk about during the hour.
Yes. Is your doctor laughing at you?
Well, I often laugh at my doctor.
That's not the same thing.
No, it isn't.
And we're also going to talk about the longevity gap. In other words, the difference between America's health and the health of other industrialized countries. Is that due to our habits or is it due to the healthcare system?
Oh, the healthcare system certainly under debate these days. What is our recipe?
Edamame hummus. Now, hummus is a common thing that people often use in dip. Edamame is something that is a soy product we don't often use. We're going to talk about that, how to make it, and baked wonton chips. It's a low-fat recipe, delicious, it's easy, it will blow away your guests at your next party. You're going to want to hear this recipe.
Don't forget about our medical mythbuster, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, and a listener now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I was calling because I had a question about something I've noticed recently. I am a runner, and I've been running for most of my life. And at the end of runs, or maybe during the middle of a run when I stop, my legs shake. And I never thought this was odd, but when I start running with other people, they point out that this never happens to them, and I wondered what it could be.
Now, they shake. You mean when you sit down?
No, when I stand, if I'm at a red light, my legs will shake, or at the end of the run for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, they'll shake.
Uh-huh. Is your cell phone on vibrate?
No, I don't run with my cell phone.
Is your cell phone on vibrate?
I'm just trying to do a little...
Cell phone on vibrate. All of a sudden, you see people shaking around. It sounds like a commercial for Verizon or something like that. You know, it's an odd thing. Is it just your legs or your arms?
Yep.
Your
it's
whole
just
body?
My legs.
Mm-hmm. How much do you run? How far?
My weekly average is about 45 to 50 miles.
That's a lot of miles.
It happens on runs from maybe 3 to 5 miles, or after my first marathon, they shook for a long time.
Okay, so they shake after that. When you run for a mile, do they shake or not?
They will sometimes, especially if it's been a hard mile.
Uh-huh. So what you're really looking at, it sounds to me that what you're looking at is fatigue. That it's fatigue within the muscles, that you're sort of at the end of the run. You know, some people, when they're done with a hard run, you know, they get kind of tired, they get weak, their muscles kind of feel like they're weak, they kind of walk around. If you look at runners at the end of a marathon, for instance, they look like they're sort of dying, you know, they're so...
You feel like you're dying, too.
You said, that's exactly it, that's it. You look like you're dying, you feel like you're dying, you feel kind of washed out. And what you're looking at is a variation of that, you know, a variation of weakness. It's like, I've used up all my strength in my muscles, all my strength in my legs, and basically you can hardly stand up, and that's what the shaking is.
Okay.
And it's just obvious in your legs because you're shaking. And in other people's, it's not necessarily like that. They just kind of walk around slowly. So there's nothing abnormal about it. Now, I've got a question. So your friends have mentioned it. Is that because it looks odd to them? Or?
Well, yeah. We'll run as a group, and I'll stop for a moment, and my legs will be shaking, and they'll all be fine, and none of them have ever experienced this before.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was just kind of normal because it's always happened to me. But,
right. Well, it is normal for your body. Now, are you faster than they are?
Not much.
Not really.
If I am, not by much.
If you are, not by much. But I think it's basically from the long runs. This is simply a representation of fatigue. It means you're really doing a great workout with your legs, great workout with your body. Keep up the good work. There's nothing abnormal about
it. Could she do some leg exercises to strengthen the legs?
I don't think so. I just think it's representative of fatigue. You know, you could do less running. You could, you know, run and be behind the group. You don't want to do that.
No.
So.
Oh, no, not at all.
Keep up the good work. Keep up the good work. Running is great until you finally reach the 40,000 mile mark on your legs, and then it's walking. Then it's fast walking, and life changes. And that's also good.
Well, hopefully I can keep running as long as possible.
Right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What's this, Zorba, about doctors laughing at their patients?
Well, this actually, it's an interesting article. It looked at doctors in training laughing at patients, okay? So it looked at doctors in training. This was had to do with a survey of internal medicine doctors, okay, of whether or not doctors were making fun of their patients. And, it's a touchy subject. And the survey showed that about 17% of them, if it's 20%, it's 1 out of 5. So between 1 out of 5 and 1 out of 6 doctors had admitted to making fun of their patients, and in some cases making fun of their patients when the patients were under anesthesia.
Uh-huh.
And this, by the way, is a long-standing issue among hospitals and training programs. And I remember many, many years ago at the University of Wisconsin, we had a chancellor, Donna Shalala, who was head of health and social services under President Clinton. And she made a statement medical school-wide, and this had to do with jokes. And basically it said, that this is a number of years ago, jokes that were sexist or off-color jokes would not be tolerated under any condition and would be reason from dismissal. And then it made a broad statement which basically said, from the lowest worker bee to the head surgeon in the surgical suite, anytime it's reported, it'll go in front of a committee and will be, used as a reason for dismissal. And it immediately stopped. It, stopped in one day. It was very, very interesting. So that people became more respectful, which is important.
Those particular kinds of sexist...
Well, the question is, where do you draw the line with making fun?
Let's cut through this.
Yeah.
You're a doctor.
Yeah.
You laugh at patients.
Well, there's some patients that I laugh at, but I don't laugh at patients who are seriously ill. These have to do with issues of strange
I'm
situations.
I'm one of your patients. Yeah, you laugh at me.
I laugh at you all the time.
I know, see? I'm not the only one.
But you're laughable. I know you're on a personal basis. But I more commonly laugh with patients than behind the backs of patients.
Right. Okay.
No, but there are issues that get involved every day with situations.
This kind of is a non-issue, I think, because you take any subset of humans.
Right.
Any profession,
absolutely,
lawyers, plumbers,
absolutely,
they laugh at some of their clients
absolutely,
and some of the...
There's absolutely the case. And especially if you're under an egregious or difficult situation.
I mean, I used to do an issues talk show, callers calling in.
Yes, you did.
You think I didn't laugh at the callers after the show was over? Did you hear this dope? Ha ha! I mean, and every other
that
profession
is absolutely,
does, and
that
doctors
is absolutely
are
the
no
case.
Different. They're that regular human beings.
So for people to look at physicians as being sort of ultra-formal, like Marcus Welby, and Dr. Kildare from years ago, where they are totally respectful when it never crossed the line. Well, that never really existed. It was television, and it didn't really exist. And we like to look at our physicians as ultra-formal. And frankly, 5 or 10% of them are ultra-formal. But when they go home and they talk to their spouse, they often will engage in the same situation.
We're human
the
issue beings. Is, sometimes we're laughable. People laugh at it.
Except, the issue is, how do you do it in a respectful manner and in an unrespectful manner? And that, I think, is the issue that you learn with training.
And on this show, we do what Zorba just said. We don't laugh
we never
at
do.
The... We
never.
Laugh with.
Never.
We laugh.
That's right. We never,
laugh.
Ever... We get all of our callers. We give them complete respect. Unlike our listeners, who sometimes laugh at patients that they hear on the radio. We never do that.
That's
right, Tom? Right, Tom.
Right. 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Troy, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine. Tell us what's up, and we promise not to laugh.
You just laugh. I hope not.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is, what is a healthy way to gain weight, to put on healthy calories?
Well, how much do you weigh, and how tall are you?
150 pounds, and... I'm 5'9".
Uh-huh. Why do you want to put on weight?
Because I think that if I put on more weight, I'll be the ideal image that I have of myself.
Oh.
Well, I think that's a good
but
one.
But 5'9", 150.
You know, Tom is a slim person.
I'm 6 foot and I weigh 150.
Tom is
oh,
a
really?
Slim person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whenever we talk about weight, Tom always takes the side of the slim person who's pleased with their weight. That's what it is. See, and I never laugh at Tom. Never. Because he's my buddy.
Yeah.
But that's always the situation. You bring up an interesting point. You know, in America, most people want to lose weight because they want to get down there. And I recently came back from a trip to India. And I was working at a Tibetan hospital that I'm helping do some work on and supporting. And I was working with Dr. Satan, who's a Tibetan doctor, about this. And about about 20 to 30% of the people who came in wanted to gain weight. So here it is. Everyone there wanted to gain weight. And it reminded me that 5 to 10% of the population in the U.S. wants to gain weight. They don't all want to lose weight. They want to gain weight. So you're looking to gain muscle, right?
Yes.
So I've got a couple of good suggestions. I mean, you know, first of all, I think body image is important. Unfortunately, body image is often determined in, you know, on Madison Avenue in New York, and it's based on advertising with body image. So you look at women, for instance, you know, the body image is about 20% below what is an appropriate weight. You know, that's what those models have, and they sell clothes. You know, so from a woman point of view, that's it. But for men, the image is more of a muscular, macho sure. type image with that. So high protein, lots of workout. That's how you do it. So you don't do it with carbs. You don't do it with carbohydrates because they will tend more likely to put on fat. You don't do it with, you know, with high greasy foods. You tend to eat protein, mm-hmm. and protein is more likely, if you exercise, to become protein. So you look for things like fish, which is a healthy protein. You look at soybean, which is a healthy protein, although it has some oil in it. It's a healthy vegetarian protein. Mm-hmm. You look at poultry, and you tend to stay away from red meat because it's the least
healthy. And the workout should be what? Pumping iron?
Anything that pumps iron and makes muscle mass. So do you go to the gym?
No, I actually do push-ups at home.
How many push-ups do you do in the morning or in the evening?
Probably about 60.
It's a lot of push-ups.
Yeah.
But to bulk it up, it's exercise and protein. That's the way to go.
Yeah. And thanks a lot for the call.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah. You've been pumping iron, Zorba.
I'm pumping iron. That's right, baby.
Have you gained any weight?
Not a pound, no. But I'm not trying to gain weight.
No, I know.
I'm in Wisconsin. I'm trying to lose weight. No, I'm not. I'm at the weight that I want to be. I've been exercising because about 6 months ago, I thought, you know what? I feel okay, but will I feel better with regular exercise? And my exercise is on and off. Oh, I feel great. There's no comparison.
Looking good, too. I got to say. Looking good. Looking good, Zorba.
I got to be careful about this show.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Just saying.
I'm married.
to a listener now, Zorba, in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. What's up?
Well, I have a niece who's been diagnosed with burning mouth syndrome. And she's been suffering for it probably for over a year, and I just was curious as whether you know what causes it, and more important, what can be done to sort of help the symptoms.
What symptoms does she have? Her mouth burns, I guess,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, and it's dry, it's sensitive to any spicy foods, even toothpaste. It's apparently her tongue is sort of beet red, and it just... very painful.
And this is with her all the time?
Yes.
Wow.
Who has she gone to see?
Well, she's gone to a doctor in Florida where she is, and there was at one point some mix of a mouthwash, a prescription mouthwash that seemed to give some relief, mm-hmm. but apparently it's something you can't stay on all the time.
Right. Well, there are a few mouthwashes that are used. One is called Peridex, P-E-R-I-D-E-X, and that's a prescription mouthwash, which you can use and sometimes will ameliorate and change sensitivities in the mouth. That's a prescription-only mouthwash, and you have to brush your teeth after you use the mouthwash because the mouthwash can yellow the teeth.
Oh,
it's interesting.
Okay.
You have to brush your teeth then with a toothpaste. Is she going to get a second opinion on this?
She's got a primary care doctor, and she's gone, you know, and they've done tests, and it doesn't seem to be getting anywhere.
Well, one of the things when you've got these problems that do not have a simple solution, you know, one solution, by the way, for anyone who has a hypersensitivity of the mouth is change toothpaste to an ultra-low sensitive toothpaste. Sensodyne is the most common one. There are a number of others that are on the market. Or go to pure baking soda, just baking soda, and that often works. Tom is making
well,
it yucky.
Well, that isn't, your mouth doesn't burn.
No, but sometimes it's the issue of the toothpaste that you use that makes it sensitive. So that's one issue. Mm-hmm. Number two is avoiding hot, spicy foods because that will do it. And number three is repopulating the mouth with the appropriate bacteria, lactobacillus, either by capsules that are called probiotics. You can buy them in health food stores. Or having yogurt, which is a natural food yogurt that has live culture, and keeping the yogurt in the mouth and sort of when you're eating the yogurt very slowly so it basically repopulates the mouth. It has to say live culture. So those are things that you can do. But I'm a great believer in second opinions. And I think a second opinion, we used to say an expert was someone from 100 miles away with slides. It was an expert. It was no joke in medicine, you know. You had the same thing back home because you're 100 miles away with slides. So I'm a great believer that an expert is somebody who is 100 miles away. They don't have to have slides, but they are. And the reason is that they should be farther away is that they're not as likely to be, quote, respectful of the doctors in your area. They're much more likely to give a real second opinion. Well, I don't know what this is about, and I recommend this or that. But if she has this, she's had it for how long?
I think it's been over a year.
If it's over a year and she's had it, she's got to go somewhere else, and she has to go somewhere where somebody has an idea of what this is. I am not an expert in this, but she needs to find somebody, and that would be somebody, an ear, nose, and throat doctor or a dentist, one of the two. Call up the office. You go to a university environment, a dental school or a medical school, and that's where she's going to get the best second opinion for this. So good luck. You obviously care a lot about her.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're
sure.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for the call. And Zorba, before we get to your yummy recipe, which name I can't pronounce, we'll take a moment here to help out another over-the-road truck driver. This question comes to us from Dennis, who drives a rig in Wisconsin. He has a busy schedule and rarely has time to fit in workouts at the end of his hectic days. He's wondering if it's healthier to sacrifice some sleep for a workout or vice versa.
Well, that's a tough question.
Sleep
isn't it? Yeah.
Versus
I'm a great believer in 8 to 9 hours of sleep. And it's fascinating when the Dalai Lama was here, and I've heard him numerous times. As you know, Tom, I'm involved with Tibetan causes.
Yes.
And people ask him basically, what's the secret of life? That's not what they say, but they'll say, how do you calm yourself, or what's the important thing? The first thing that comes out of his mouth is, I get a lot of sleep.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because you picture him. He gets up at 3:30 in the morning, but he goes to sleep at 8 o'clock at night, and he says sleep is very important. On the other hand, he also exercises 20 to 30 minutes a day. So he does both. So my belief is that you really need a balance between it. And if you're finding that you're working really, really hard and you don't have time for either one, maybe you borrow a little bit from each, but you've got to change the other part of your lifestyle. So I think it's very important that we have 20 minutes three times a week that we work out with our bodies, roughly. That's roughly 1 hour a week. We have to find it somewhere. Shouldn't be on the same day. It ought to be broken up into 2 days. Optimal is three, but 2 days would be fine. So you've got to find that hour when you're going to do something. You may want to do it at your house, so you develop these rubber bands that you buy, a whole bunch of different torque systems that are very easy. They sell them at sporting goods stores, so you can do it and you don't have to go to the gym because that takes more time. But on the other hand, you've got to look for sleep there too. So I would take a little bit from sleep to do the workout, but I would just be aware of the fact that I'd have to try to change my lifestyle to see if I can grab a bit from my job.
You would think that it wouldn't be that hard to come up with an hour, hour and a half in a week.
People are stressed at the extremes. You would think so. People are stressed at the extremes. They have problems at home. They're often working 40 to 60 to 80 hours a week in order to pay the mortgage and pay the bills. And then I now have to exercise. We often waste our time doing other things. It's hard to find time to do what you want. But that often means that you don't value what you're looking for, and you often can grab it somewhere else. And you got to snoop around and see where it is. So that's my answer.
Yeah, interesting.
A bit of both. Need balance.
Even when you're not behind the wheel, we want to hear from you. Just send your lifestyle questions, comments, and tips to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe coming up, some more of your calls, of course, some interesting research, our medical myth buster, lots of great reasons for you to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. That's the number you use if you have a question for Zorba. Callers waiting and a line open for you now at 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, it is, of course, recipe time. And this one sounds right up my alley. Hummus. Some kind of enemy or something hummus with wonton. Yum, yum. Let's do it.
Edamame. So first of all, what is edamame? Yeah. Edamame is a Japanese soybean. If you've ever gone to a Japanese restaurant and ordered it as an appetizer, it's a common appetizer. Usually it's in a pod. And the pods come, you open up the pod, and you eat it. It's a green soybean that often has a taste to it because it's baked and steeped in, for instance, in teriyaki sauce. You can also buy the dried edamame beans, which often have a hot spice around it, and they're very, very popular as a Japanese snack. So edamame turns out to be something that's useful. Hummus says, as you know, has a certain taste to it, and how we use it. It's made with garbanzo beans. And this is sort of a variation on the recipe. And the recipe that I have from Nancy Ross Ryan. She's a good friend of mine, cookbook editor in Chicago. Mm-hmm. She developed it with Jackie Chen, a cookbook that she's writing for it. The nice thing about it is I'm also giving, within this recipe, baked wonton chips. So you can bring homemade low-fat chips to your next, to the next potluck. That you're going to, because Tom's not going there.
This sounds kind of good. Remember the days way back when Adam used to make these dishes for us?
And do you remember what transpired?
He got married.
Right, he got married.
He stopped cooking.
I don't know what happened, but as soon as he got married, all of a sudden, nothing gets cooked anymore. He shows up late for work. He's disheveled when he comes to work. His whole life has changed ever since he got married. I just can't imagine what's going on.
Okay, well, anyway, even though we don't have this, let's go through it.
We could try to have it. Okay, so you start out with 1 cup a frozen shelled edamame. So where do you get edamame? You get it in a grocery store. In the frozen food sections, often has edamame. Now, this is often a store that will also have an Asian section in the store. Okay. So, I mean, that's what it is. I had no trouble, by the way, looking at grocery stores in Madison, Wisconsin. They all had it.
Oh.
They basically all
so,
had it.
Cup of frozen shelled edamame.
That's right. And that's how it comes. But they also come in the shells because, as I said, it's an appetizer in the shell. So you want to buy the shelled. 1/2 small garlic.
A half a small garlic.
A clove. Garlic you can use. 1/2 a Thai chili or a serrano pepper. So this is to give it a little bit of spice.
Oh.
So what you want to do with the Thai chili or serrano pepper, which is a Mexican pepper, is take the seeds out because you're giving it a little bit of bite. But if you leave the seeds in, it will have a lot of bite. So a little bit of bite would most people would like.
1/2 a Thai chili or a small serrano pepper.
That's right. And if you want to give it more bite, then add more to it or leave the seeds in. The seeds carry basically the hotness that's within there. Two tablespoonfuls of teriyaki sauce.
2 big T teriyaki sauce.
You can use soy. Doesn't taste as good. Teriyaki sauce really works out better. So that's the hummus. That's the edamame. And then for the wonton chips, what you have to buy is a package of wonton chips. They come in a package. And what you're going to use is cooking spray. And by the way, you also need some canola oil, 1/4 cup of canola oil.
Okay.
Which is basically 2 ounces of canola oil. Mm-hmm. So here's how you make it. Cook the edamame according to the package directions. In other words, it tells you how to cook it. Basically, you put a great big pot of water, put a little bit of salt in the water, and cook it for 3 to 5 minutes. But follow the package instructions. Then drain it. When it's cool enough to handle, place all the other ingredients, the garlic, the Thai chili or serrano, teriyaki sauce, and the 1/4 cup canola oil in a food processor and fit it with a steel blade and process it until it's pureed. Now, this is how you have to process it. It takes about 3 minutes. You give it a spurt on the food processor, and then you push down the sides of the food processor. You give it a spurt, and you do it again. Otherwise, the outside will have chunks. Then, in a small bowl, press the plastic wrap over the surface, and you can put it in the refrigerator, and you can do this 3 days before your event. Very simple, but you've got to make sure that there's plastic on top of it. Otherwise, it'll get brown. Mm-hmm. It has to have no air at all. but you've got to wrap it tightly. Now, here's how you make the wontons. Preheat the oven at 350 degrees. Take the wonton wrappers, make them into two stacks of about 12. Cut them in half with a sharp serrated knife. If you don't use a serrated knife, it'll tend to mush a little bit, which is what you don't want to have it. So a nice serrated knife. And you're making little triangles. Wonton wrappers are square. You want to make them into triangles. Cut them in half. Put them on a parchment paper so it won't stick, and spray it lightly with cooking spray. You can use olive oil cooking spray or regular cooking spray. Put it in the preheated oven on the middle rack until they're brown and crispy. So this is a low-fat chip. Not charred, takes about 6 or 7 minutes. Remove the chips. Put them at room temperature again. You want to put them in a container to keep the air away from them. And you've got a very interesting dynamite recipe. And if you want to put them on a plate, you would take a little hummus and put it on each chip and then put half of a grape tomato, grape-sized tomato on top of it.
Like Japanese food, it sounds like it's kind of a work of art.
It is a work of art, yes. Yeah. And it's a very interesting taste because people look at it and it's not the dense texture of hummus. It's a light texture. It's a very, very interesting
recipe. It sounds kind of good.
Highly recommend.
Yeah. For those who would like this recipe,
come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can get this recipe, all the other fine recipes, see pictures of Tom and I, and sign up for our weekly podcast.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, my husband recently was put on Coumadin, and I was given a list of foods that are high in vitamin K because vitamin K helps the blood clot, and he's supposed to avoid quite a bit of them. So it's like, well, what do I do? Because we've always eaten huge salads and lots of green leafy vegetables in this house.
Forget the list. That's what you do. Forget the list. You don't do that at all.
Well, that's easy to forget when you're my age.
Forget the list. Don't forget the doctor, but forget the list. And I'll tell you why. First of all, some people are cuckoo when it comes to foods to avoid when you're on Coumadin. You don't have to be cuckoo about it. You have to be fairly regular about the foods that you eat so Coumadin can be adjusted. So in other words, let's assume every other day or every day you're always eating green leafy vegetables and broccoli. Just make it more regular so that they can adjust the Coumadin about, you know, around it. And let me explain another issue. For some people, foods make a huge difference. So in other words, if they double the amount of broccoli they eat, the blood becomes too thin, if you will, and the Coumadin, and they have to adjust the Coumadin. For other people, they're remarkably stable, and the Coumadin doesn't have to be adjusted.
Help me out. What's wrong with me if I'm put on Coumadin, Zorba?
Well, Coumadin, you're put on for, well, first of all, what's your husband put on the Coumadin for?
Atrial fibrillation.
It's the most common reason that you're put on it. And atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular beating of the upper chamber of the heart, is associated with an increased risk of stroke.
Okay.
We found out a number of years ago that we could reduce that risk dramatically by the use of the blood thinner Coumadin. And for years, people have tried to find other drugs that will replace Coumadin. We have found fabulous drugs that work as well as Coumadin, but unfortunately, they have a side effect, liver failure. So none of those drugs have reached the marketplace. Coumadin is a very finicky drug, very finicky, very, very tricky. A little bit too much and your blood is too thin and you're more likely to have a bleed in your brain or somewhere else in your body. A little too little and your blood is more likely to clot, and then you may have this stroke, the clot type stroke. So you've got to regulate it. For some people, this means once a month for a blood test. For some people, it's once every week or two because they can't get it regulated. For some people, diet makes a big difference. So you've got to avoid the foods. And for other people, diet doesn't mean much at all. My recommendation is eat your food the way you normally eat your food, and then see essentially what happens to the test that they do, which is called the INR test, which basically is the clotting test.
He was hoping that he wouldn't ever have to eat green vegetables again. You're like a little kid. Now I don't have to eat my vegetables.
I love it.
Oh, well. Thank you so much for your answer. And you're welcome for taking my call, and go Bills.
Boo!
Boo! That's right, boo!
800-462-7413. She was calling from Buffalo, in case
I got it.
I know you did. But it's just for listeners who may not have been paying attention. 800-462-7413. And a listener now in Farragut, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
My question concerns belly fat. Is it a health risk? Does it indicate a health risk? And how can you get rid of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, belly fat does definitely indicate a health risk. You know, it's abdominal fat. You were going to comment.
I was just wondering if this was just an intellectual curiosity on your part, or if there's some reason that you.
I bike every day. Well, not every day. Maybe 3 days a week, mm-hmm. 25 miles each day. I exercise, eat right. I'm not a big person. I weigh maybe 125 pounds. My husband thinks I'm nuts to worry about this, but it seems like it's always been there from probably the bottom of my rib cage to the center of my, just below my navel.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get rid of it.
You probably won't ever be able to get rid
of it. 125 pounds.
Yeah. First of all, it's belly fat to the excessive amount. We're not talking about abdominal girth to a smaller amount. Right. What's your waist size?
I'm probably 30, maybe 26.
You are nowhere near any risk factor for heart disease based on that. The question is whether or not what the magic number should it be? Should it be 36 inches, 38 inches, 40 inches, or 42 inches? And we don't have any standards with these numbers. It'll be different for men and for women, that's for sure. But we now know that excessive belly fat, and we're talking about guys who have their bellies basically going over their belt,
And this is more of a problem for men than women.
No, it's more of a problem for all of us. It's just more common in men than in women.
Well, that's what I meant.
It's more common in men than women, because women tend to put their fat in their buttocks and in their upper legs. And one theory is that men may have more heart disease because they put their abdominal fat in their belly, and that may be the issue. It may be that belly fat is a risk factor for reasons that we don't quite understand on how fat is metabolized and stored. Getting back to your case, mm-hmm. people are built with different bodies. Period. They're built with different bodies. The people who run gyms and marathons, you know, would like us to believe that everyone, all the guys, can have muscular bodies with 5% fat on them and look like models. And the answer is they can't. Mm-hmm. Some people are born more handsome than others. Some people are born with more muscle mass than others.
Thank you, Zorba.
Every time I say that, you think I'm talking about you,
I'm
Tom.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
I'm talking generally. Yeah. I'm even talking about myself.
You're both beautiful.
Now there's a true public radio listener.
No, there's a very kind person who has a little lying problem.
I think we're almost ready to end this conversation. Yeah. Quit while I'm ahead. Yes. But getting back to the issue, so you have a little bit more you have some more fat on your belly. That's mm-hmm. what it is, and it's always been the way that you're built. Just like some guys can have a wasteboard stomach as six-pack, and some women also have fat bellies. They have stronger abdominal muscles and less fat there. It is not a health concern, and if it's been that way, it will be there forever. The only way to get rid of it, frankly, is by a cosmetic procedure, liposuction. You're not about to do that. You could lose it if you went down to 98 pounds, and I'm serious, which you're not going to do, but if you went down to 95 or 98 pounds, so you had, we'll say, 5 to 10% body fat, you would not have that belly fat, but it wouldn't be healthy. And that's what you see when I do my travels in Asia, and I'm often working in medical type situations. I'll see women, and they have no fat at all on their body, and they have no fat anywhere on their body, on their buttocks, on their breasts, or in their belly, and they don't necessarily look healthy at all, and they often want to gain weight. So you're never going to get rid of that, short of what we said, short of a surgical procedure, but it doesn't put you at risk for anything.
I appreciate your show. It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate your call. Zorba, as you know, not all of the mail in the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox agrees with you. So here's some constructive criticism from a listener named Judy for this edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Judy writes, on a recent program, a woman called to ask about diet. You told her the calorie count of a Big Mac meal with a small Coke and then commented that no one who listens to public radio eats at McDonald's. Well, guess what? I eat at McDonald's and I work at McDonald's. I wish to challenge you to take a look at the real McDonald's, the company that buys and sells more apples than any other restaurant in America. We offer exceptional quality and great healthy choices. Happy meals come with apples and wonderful Wisconsin milk. Our Southwest salad is amazingly full of flavor and is low calorie and healthy. Take a look at the salad blend that we use. Pretty dark green. We purchase our food from the same people who supply your local grocery store.
First of all, when I said nobody eats at McDonald's, I was kind of joking.
That was
about
a joke.
Yeah, right. I didn't mean to say that. But I think she brings up some really good points. First of all, if you look at where most of the food that's served at McDonald's and fast food restaurants, most of it is the high fat food. They do serve salads. They do make salads, but I'm not sure if it's 80% of their stuff comes from burgers and fries and other things that are relatively high fat. But I think she brings up a good point that you can go to fast food restaurants. I have gone to McDonald's. I've had their salads. And I've gone to all the other fast food restaurants and had their salads. And frankly, the salads that they make now are much better than they used to be. They used to be iceberg lettuce type of salads. And, you know, you can go to your typical restaurant and often it was iceberg a salad, a tomato that didn't taste very good, and a high-fat dressing. So she brings up a good point. If you go to fast food, you can choose right. The issue is with all food is choosing right. Yeah. So thank you very much. I'm glad she brought that up. And she's right. Fast food has good choices. It's a matter of making those.
Thanks, Judy. And if you have comments, questions, or tips, send them to the show at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More research coming up, our medical myth buster, and more of your great calls here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up, but first, we have, of course, a big debate going on now in the country about changing our healthcare system. Zorba, here's a researcher that suggests that maybe it's not a good debate point for those who want to change to use our shorter longevity in this country compared to other countries. He suggests that we die sooner in this country for other reasons than our healthcare system.
Well, he is a very interesting researcher, looked at health habits and said maybe the difference between longevity is really due to health habits. And he looked back at health habits, and Americans were exceptionally heavy smokers years ago. We were the highest smoking country in the world if we look back in the 60s and the 70s and actually in the mid 80s. If we look at obesity, we're really pretty much up there with the fattest country in the world. And so if we look at our health habits, we don't exercise, we don't move around as much. Maybe it's not due to our healthcare system. Maybe it's only due to the fact that we are not good people in terms of what we're doing with our lives. I think it's kind of an interesting thing. On the other hand, if you're not insured, what happens? Well, you go to the hospital and you end up getting medical care, and it may not be of the same quality only because you haven't been following up with medical care on
certainly
a regular basis.
And he recognizes that we have great problems with healthcare in this country. He just says that we can't really scientifically link those problems with dying earlier.
I think he's got a very good point. I think if we look at dying earlier, it's really a combination of health habits and it's a combination of what we're doing. The perfect example is years ago, once you were 50, no one even thought about exercising in the 1960s. Now we see people exercising in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and that has dropped disability in this country from 35%. 35% of people 65 and older used to be disabled. Now, if we look back at people 65 and older, it's dropped below 20%. And that's due to good health habits. So I think it's a combination of health habits and medical care.
He says the problem is in our midlife in this country. As you mentioned, smoking and diet and those things, that if you can get to a certain age, 70s or 80 maybe, then you're in pretty good shape.
Well, 70s and 80s aren't necessarily midlife. That's sort of older life.
I'm saying if you can get past middle age.
Yeah. Once you get past middle age in their 70s or 80s, it's the same. On the other hand, if you look at people 65 and older in this country, they have Medicare. They don't have the fear they're not going to be taken care of. And Medicare was a great boon to senior citizens, no matter what anyone says. It is the most desired program of the U.S. government. It was very important.
And he also says we do some things pretty well in this country, better than other countries, like finding colon cancer quickly and treating heart disease.
Absolutely. And the same for breast cancer awareness and so on. So I think it's a combination of habits on one side, access on the other side. And what's very important is we have to continue to carry on this discussion so that America becomes a healthier, happier place.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Santa Teresa, New Mexico. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
I had some concerns about recent tests on PSA and its relationship to prostate cancer and the levels that were screened.
Now, did you say you had a test for PSA?
I've had a number of tests.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How old are you?
I am 59.
Okay, you're 59. What'd your doctor recommend?
My doctor recommended my seeing a specialist,
okay.
A urologist.
Mm-hmm. And a biopsy?
And that's the question is the only alternative a biopsy, or I've been reading some things on finasteride.
Well, here's the issue. The issue with PSA and prostate cancer is it's the most controversial cancer that we have. It's filled with controversy. Why? Because most men who have prostate cancer die with it, not of it. If you do autopsies of men in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they all have prostate cancer. 80-year-olds, 80% of them have prostate cancer. 70-year-olds, 70% of them have prostate cancer, roughly. But they don't die of prostate cancer. On the other hand, 25,000 guys a year die of prostate cancer. In other words, it's not as if no one dies. None of the guys die of it. So we don't have a good way of differentiating bad prostate cancer from prostate cancer that doesn't mean much. Now, in the 50s, if you're in your 50s and you have a rapid increase in PSA, like it goes from 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 over a short period of time, we make an assumption, the prostate-specific antigen, that it may be prostate cancer. And the gold standard is you go in, you might have or might not have an ultrasound to your prostate, but the gold standard is a biopsy. That's the gold standard. You don't have a diagnosis made. So the question is, how do you make the diagnosis? The biopsy is the most likely way to make the diagnosis. Well, what do you do with the biopsy afterwards? What if you have prostate cancer? What sort of treatment do you have? That's the controversy. That's the controversy. I don't think you need finasteride in order to shrink your prostate and bring down the PSA because you don't have a diagnosis. So I don't think that's a good idea. I think watchful waiting is okay. That's the European way. And you may say, well, I want to repeat the test in 6 months or a year. I think that's great because a lot of times you repeat the test, it goes down because an enlarged prostate can also produce extra PSA. So just because it's higher doesn't mean you have prostate cancer, but I wouldn't put a chemical in my body. There's a lot of people who have guys who have prostate cancer who have normal PSAs. If you go and do research on the web, you'll go, why are we using this test? It's such a goofy, awful test. Well, that's a good question. So I used to call the PSA the Full Urology Employment Act. That's what I called it. And that's what a lot of primary care docs call it, because you send a PSA, you know, to a urologist, somebody who's got an elevated PSA, and they say biopsy right away. But the answer is you don't have an answer without the biopsy. That's the bottom line.
Very good. Well, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413.
You know, whenever we talk about prostate, whenever we talk about PSA, we get a flurry of emails. Why? Because it's the most controversial test in medicine, and the controversy goes on.
Well, time now, Zorba, for our medical myth. We have a listener myth today, and it comes to us from Dick in St. Catharines, Ontario. He writes, some people tell me that if you're on antibiotics, you shouldn't drink that alcohol interferes with the antibiotic action. Others say nonsense. Who is right?
Well, they're right, and they are the ones who say you shouldn't mix alcohol with antibiotics. They're
really?
Absolutely right. Yes, yes, it's not a myth. And the reason is there are a number of antibiotics, for instance, an antibiotic called Bactrim Sulfapyl. Mm-hmm. If you mix it, you're more likely to have side effects, and it can reduce some of the effectiveness of the antibiotic. A drug called Flagyl, which is a drug that is often given in addition to other antibiotics, can produce more nausea and vomiting. And drinking any alcohol can produce flushing, headache, nausea. If somebody has it, you don't know if it's from your drink or if it's from your antibiotics. My recommendation is that if you're on an antibiotic, stay away from the alcohol. But the real question is, what about one drink? What about if I take my pill at breakfast and supper? And what if before I go to sleep, do I want to have a nightcap? And yeah. The answer is, if you're feeling okay after 1 or 2 days, then it's okay to have the drink. So have I answered the myth?
No.
That's right. Controversy again. Controversy again. You can't always answer these myths with a yes or a no.
You mentioned two or three antibiotics, but does this apply to all antibiotics?
No, it's just, well, the side effect issue can apply to all antibiotics, but the interaction doesn't necessarily apply to all antibiotics. But, I mean, do you really think you're going to go to the pharmacy and get a list and the pharmacist can say, okay, you can have booze with these antibiotics and you can't have booze with those antibiotics? We're a puritanical society, not drinking is always good for us. That's what we always think. I think it's okay after 1 or 2 days to have a drink with your antibiotic. But at first, you shouldn't because you don't know, A, you're having it for a purpose, and you might be sick because you've got an infection, and yeah. B, you won't know if you're tolerating the antibiotic or not. So stay away from any alcohol for a couple of days.
And when you're talking about a drink, you're meaning a drink.
Yeah. A drink, Tom. Now, remember, in some cultures, a drink can be like, you know, a two-fingered shot of whiskey. We're talking about an ounce and a half of alcohol, a beer, a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm. If you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And if we don't bust them, at least we can bring them to the light of day and discuss them.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Bay City, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
We're fine. How can we help you?
I have been having really bad problems with dandruff since last winter.
Okay.
So I was just wondering, because I've tried a couple different things. I've tried a lot of scalp treatments, a lot of moisturizing treatments, and nothing's really worked on it. And I talked to my hairstylist, and she said we've done everything possible from the outside. She said it has to be something on the inside, some kind of vitamin deficiency or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what Zorba had to say.
First, I'll ask you what shampoo you use.
I use a special salt-free shampoo. It's like an organic shampoo.
Please, Tom, go on.
I don't know what he'll ask after that.
Please, go on.
I'm sorry to preempt your question.
Yeah, that's it. That was my first question. Now, have you ever used a tar shampoo, or have you gone to Selenium, Selsun Blue, or...
I have tried that, and it hasn't helped. I did use it for quite a while. I used, run-of-the-mill, like, Pantene Pro-V,
uh-huh.
And I went up to even some really expensive...
No, but I'm talking about ones like Selsun Blue that are not that expensive but have chemicals in it. Have you talked to your doctor about this?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
I got some good questions. Nizoral shampoo, Nizoral, works about 80 to 90% of the time. It's a prescription shampoo. You put it on your head, let it sit for 5 minutes, and then wash it off. And then if you want to do your scalp with a regular shampoo on top of that, you can do it. But generally, you need a stronger scalp treatment. And it's a prescription scalp treatment. You can also, there's a pill you can take, which are Nizoral pills and other pills, but we reserve those for when the local treatment does not work. There are a variety of medicated shampoos, including tar shampoos, that can often get it under control. And after it's under control, you only have to use the medicated shampoo once or twice a week. So you need to talk to your doc. You don't have a vitamin deficiency. This is called seborrhea. It's a common problem. There are a number of good prescription shampoos that you can use, but you need to talk to your family doc or your primary person.
Okay. Well, thank you, Zorba.
You're welcome. And call us back and let us know. And I'm sure once you solve the seborrhea problem, you will have lustrous, beautiful, flowing hair just like the commercials.
Of course. Thanks a lot for the call. Before we sign off here, Zorba, we have another case for Judge Zorba. It's the case of the side effects and comes to us from Sarasota, Florida listener George, who is the husband/defendant. He writes, "My wife just had her high blood pressure medicine refilled, and the pharmacy listed side effects as drowsiness, lightheadedness, or dizziness, which describes the way she's been feeling for a week or so. She says it can't be side effects since she's taken this medication for several years, and side effects only occur after one starts taking a medication. My opinion is that side effects can occur just about any time, and not only within a short time after starting a new medication. Who is right, wife, husband, or neither?"
Husband. He's right. He's right. It can occur anytime. More likely to occur when you first start a medication, but it can occur anytime when you're taking it. So he is right. She is wrong.
And what's the sentence for her?
The sentence for her is to take him out to a good dinner. How's that sentence? Take him out to a good dinner. That's the sentence.
If you have a case for the next installment of Judge Zorba, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. You know, we could think of other things that she could do besides taking him out for dinner. But I think out to dinner, a day at the spa. What other things would you think about that a wife could give a husband that he would value?
Let's give it a week and to think about it, and we'll see you then.
Okay, take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Charles Monroe Kane is the executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping for you on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1010Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.